Hello, this is Teachers Talk Radio. How can I help you? I'm sorry, we no longer have the Saturday News Hour available. Would you like to try the Saturday Lunch instead? It's a new and improved version with a wider range of topics, spanning an extra half an hour. That's great. You won't regret it. I'll just put you through right now. Please hold.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Live from Nottingham, this is the Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins-Burke on Teachers Talk Radio.
Hey up, me duck, it's Saturday, it's 1 p.m. and this is the Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins-Burke. In the next 90 minutes, we have a state special and we'll be talking to US-based educators about schools, COVID and teacher pay. This is your show, so give me your views. Listen in on Podbean or call in and win a mug. Tune in, talk it out, live on Podbean. This is Teachers Talk Radio.
Live from Nottingham, this is the Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins-Burke on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
We are live and we are ready to go. Welcome to the brand new look Saturday Lunch on Teachers Talk Radio. My name is Tom Hopkins-Burke, and over the course of the next 90 minutes, we won't be looking exclusively at news stories and current educational affairs, but there will be more on that later. We will, though, be hearing from top guests about issues that are relevant and interesting to all teachers. Last week, I went solo on the final Saturday News Hour. I hosted a one-hour special on Hackney News School and the media reporting surrounding those events. If there is anyone from Hackney News School listening in today who would like to call in and set the record straight, you have an opportunity, please do. We did have some really interesting listeners listening in live, and I haven't received any complaints, so I think it went down well. Now, it's a new show title, which means we have new show music. Let's have a listen. Today's show is predominantly a state special with two great guests from across the pond. Jasmine Lane will be talking about teaching in the states during COVID and why she's moving to the UK in September. Ellen Sherritt, board chair at the Teacher Salary Project, will discuss how we can increase the value of teachers. And in between, we have Johnny Utley talking about an open letter to Ofqual signed by 24 CEOs and principals. You can share your thoughts on the show live using the Podbean app. The Saturday Lunch is live every Saturday between 1 and 2:30 p.m. An extra 30 minutes on the News Hour, and you can text in your views or call in to make your voice heard by clicking on one of the call-in icons. I'm always extremely keen to hear from you, whatever the subject, so please do tune in and talk it out. And if any of my guests are currently in the studio, then please do text in and tell me that you are here, or even call in and I will let you in. Okay, I want to know where everybody is listening from today as well. Are you listening from England? Whereabouts in England? The UK? Which part of the UK, the USA, which state in the USA, or somewhere completely different? Text in and let me know. And a very good morning to all of our live listeners from the United States. You can also tweet us at TTRadio 2021 with your thoughts on the show, both live and afterwards. And as I am the main Twitter admin, I look forward to reading your comments. And of course, any constructive criticism or suggestions for improvement are totally welcome. We have Noreen, who hosts the Wednesday Late Show every other week, saying that she is listening in her bedroom in South London. And we have Daniel Bundred, who is listening from Hackney in London. We have a special prize for the best caller today as well. So do keep on listening until the very end, when I will be handing out a very special Teachers Talk Radio mug, because we are going to be flooding staff rooms across the UK with these. I'll also be asking my US guests to nominate someone to receive a Teachers Talk Radio mug on their behalf. Everyone who calls in today to share their views, ask questions to our guests, or just to say hello, will have a chance to win this mug, and I will be awarding it at the end of the show. I have now received my mug. for calling into Niall Cole's Late Show a few weeks ago for the Room of Kerfuffle. And last night, Niall awarded a mug to Robert Peston because I nominated him for his slightly ill-thought-out comments about teachers this week. So that is one mug making its way to ITV Studios. Make sure you call in to win yours. Tom Rogers has also informed me that this show is being streamed live on social media. Thank you very much for that, Tom. You can listen live to this show on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Instagram, possibly, LinkedIn and YouTube. And I don't think it's live on Instagram, but it's live on YouTube, Twitter and Facebook, and hopefully soon LinkedIn. If you are listening on Facebook, on Twitter or on LinkedIn, a very good afternoon to you. Or if you're listening from America, then good morning. And if you want to interact with me directly, chat to me, text in, call in, then the place to be is Podbean. And hopefully you will found a link to the Podbean studio from the We Are Live tweet on Teachers Talk Radio. In the meantime, while I wait for Jasmine to call in, let's see what we have got. So while I'm waiting for Jasmine to call in, I thought, first of all, I would introduce who she is. Jasmine Lane is an early career English teacher from North Minneapolis with a background in education spanning around 6 years. She has worked in literacy-based after-school programs as a paraprofessional in a charter school and a teacher of record in a traditional high school. Jasmine has a blog which you can find at jasmineteaches.wordpress.com, where she writes about cognitive science, reading fluency, literature, vocabulary, reflections on her own experiences, and more. And as somebody myself who's applying for a whole school literacy lead position with an interview next week, very exciting, I have found Jasmine's blog hugely valuable to my own practice, and I would urge you to check it out after the show. In addition, Jasmine is moving to the UK in September to teach over here. Once Jasmine is live in the studio, you can text in with your questions for Jasmine about being a US-based educator during COVID and about her move to the UK as well. I have my own questions, but this is your show, so I want everyone in the studio right now to think of a question they have for Jasmine, and when you are ready, to send it in. No pressure at all. And if you have a question about anything Jasmine directly says, then text in or call in and ask Jasmine directly. While I'm waiting for Jasmine, I'm going to play you the latest education news, which is not from me, but it is from Sebastian. So let's have a listen.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Sebastian Sagnier.
I am Sebastian Sagnier, and this is Teachers Talk Radio with the news. The First Lady Jill Biden will be welcoming students across America to the nation's capital in a virtual trip to Washington, D.C. It is the latest virtual trip produced by Discovery Education, a global edtech leader. The Shadow's Child Poverty Minister, Wes Streeting, has warned that the government will face the impact of what he called recent grotesque school budget cuts. He also revealed he is undergoing treatment for kidney cancer. The popular Netflix show, Sex Education, is rumoured to be aired this June or July. This comes at a time of much discussion over the government's new RSE curriculum that is now compulsory for all schools. This is Teachers Talk Radio, and that was the news with me, Sebastian Sagnier.
Thank you very much for that, Sebastian. I'm just still waiting for Jasmine to come into the studio. I've just tried to message her on Twitter just to see if she's okay. I know it's very early where she was, but we've had this plan for just over a week now. So hopefully Jasmine is okay, and we're just waiting for her. So while I'm waiting for Jasmine, I'm going to riff a little bit, to go a bit ad lib, and just talk about a couple of things which were on the news. So first of all, something from the Shadow Child Poverty Minister, Wes Streeting. Wes Streeting is undergoing treatment for kidney cancer. He was the Shadow Schools Minister. He is now Shadow Minister for Child Poverty. We wish Wes all the best and a very speedy recovery. And we're also very pleased to hear that Peter Kyle is the new Shadow Schools Minister. And hopefully at some point in the next few months, we will get Peter on the show to talk about Labour's priorities for schools as we emerge from COVID. And while I'm waiting for Jasmine, I just thought I'd ask you in the studio what we think the opposition party, the Labour Party, should be prioritising in terms of schools policy. Where should they be supporting the government? Where should they be opposing the government? Okay, where has Labour got it right on schools in the past, and where has it got it wrong? And what should the priorities be? Should it be in terms of behaviour, in terms of curriculum, in terms of new school buildings, in terms of academy reform? I want to know what you think. So if you have strong views about education in politics, then this is your opportunity, while I'm waiting for Jasmine to call in, for you to call in and share those views with me. Another thing which I want to talk about while I'm waiting for Jasmine is masks in classrooms. So the government's roadmap says that masks are not required in classrooms from next month, from this coming Monday, the 17th of May. Now, this is quite interesting, actually, because I think about my setting in terms of being a school where there's been a local outbreak in the school just down the road, over 100 people self-isolating. And it's been very sort of, well, it's been alarming, really, to see what has been happening in that sense. And I know that another school very close by to me is actually keeping masks in classrooms as well. I've got a caller. Let's see who it is. I have invited them in, so hopefully they will be calling in now. And let's see who it is. Ooh, I'm still waiting. I'm going to carry on ad-libbing. So, yes, I want to know what you think. Masks in schools. We have a speaker, I hope. Is that Jasmine?
Yes.
Fantastic. We have Jasmine in the studio. How are you?
Hi. Sorry, I'm a little late.
All right, don't worry. This is my eighth show now, so I'm quite good at sort of ad-libbing and sort of waiting. It's all right. Really, really good to have you. And it sounds like we have our first guest, Jasmine Lane. Jasmine, you're an early career English teacher from North Minneapolis with a background in education spanning around 6 years, with particular interests, according to your blog, jasmineteaches.wordpress.com, in cognitive science, reading fluency, literature, vocabulary, reflections on your own experiences, and more. But I want to focus today really on your experiences of education during the COVID pandemic. And so, first of all, just tell us what time it is where you're at the moment.
It's 7:13 a.m.
7:13 a.m. So it's 1:13 p.m. here in the UK where I am. So thank you so much for calling in bright and early on a weekend as well to talk to us on Teachers Talk Radio. Let's just go back in time a little bit then. Let's go back to, say, March 2020. And tell us about what you were doing when the pandemic hit the US. What role did you have in education? And what were your initial thoughts and concerns and worries and hopes, perhaps, regarding what would happen to schools when you found out they would be closing?
Yeah, so March 2020, it was actually in the middle of my first year, like my first official year of teaching. I was in the middle of teaching Things Fall Apart. And I actually remember the week before, like, everything happened, I was actually sick on that Friday. So I took a day off, and then I remember watching the news, and I thought, like, oh, it's like nothing's gonna happen, like, we'll be back in school, you know, in a few days, like, this is just a stupid precaution. Mm-hmm. And then I was really upset about my next season. I wasn't upset with him. I had an interesting relationship with my principal. And so I was like, he's going to make us come in anyway.
Yes. No, that's interesting where sort of, you know, the interesting relationship with seniors, and you're not, I assume then from that, you weren't entirely sure what the expectations would be placed upon yourself. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah. I mean, we really didn't know anything other than, like, it was Friday and I was feeling sick, and then our schools hadn't closed yet. It was the Friday, like Friday the 13th. And then I remember I called my sister in Florida, and she said, she was like, watch, by Sunday, he's going to make a call, and schools are going to be closed by Sunday. And that's exactly what happened. Yeah, I remember, like, when it happened, all of the prices for, like, flights around the world went really, really low. A back and forth trip to London from here where I am. The ticket's normally like maybe $1,300. And it was like $600 for a round trip ticket. And so I bought one. Like, $600, this will be over in like a month, like by the summer, like I'll go and like spend a couple months in London with some of my friends.
And did you manage to get into London?
No.
we'll be talking much more about London soon, later on in the show, I imagine. So in terms of when you were working remotely, if you like, working from home, or at least teaching online, how were your initial experiences of that in the US? But first question, I suppose, which I want to think about that is, I was having a look at some of your old tweets prior to the show. It sounds like you went straight into Zoom teaching live lessons. Is that right?
Yes. Yep.
So you went straight into that. And anybody listening in the studio, especially from the UK as well, I want to know, did you have that same experience? Did you go straight into face-to-face teaching on screens, on Zoom, on Google Meet or whatever software? Or did you give resources out and not have that live element as well? Certainly, I know from my experience, I didn't teach any live lessons at all until the second main lockdown in schools from January this year. So actually, we didn't have any of that. But what went well in terms of that experiences of remote education, and what didn't?
I mean, honestly, nothing really went well. Like, online teaching, crisis teaching is honestly what I've been calling it. It's as bad as it sounds. So our schools closed on March 15th, and then we took, as a school, we took 2 weeks to like make online learning, basically. Like, mm-hmm. Took 2 weeks to put all of your curriculum online. And so we did that, and then we were just online all day.
Daniel Bundred says, we didn't go into Zoom because of serious safeguarding concerns about the platform as seen in other schools. No, we didn't go into Zoom either in our school. We did everything on Google Classroom, and we did, from January this year, we did live lessons on Google Meet, where the safeguarding procedures were much more secure, I think. What about the kids, Ben, in terms of remote education? What about your kids without access to technology, without access to a laptop or, you know, good Wi-Fi? What happened to them?
It's actually pretty common in my state for schools to have something called like a one-to-one laptop program. The entire school district of St. Paul, which is like, I think it's like 37 schools, every student in middle and high school has at least an iPad that's given to you by the district. And so in my school, every student had a Chromebook already. And if it was broken, then we gave them a new one. And then if they didn't have Wi-Fi at home, then we gave them a hotspot. That was like the one thing that we did well, was making sure that they didn't have an excuse to not participate. The Wi-Fi's not, well, get a hotspot. Like, that was pretty much the only thing that my school did well.
That's interesting to hear, because certainly, and I'm sure, you know, I can see that David Cunningham's in the studio. He hosts Wednesday Drive Home. And we've got Don Guilford, who appeared on one of my shows a few weeks ago. David's a teacher of geography. Don's a teacher of music. Daniel, I want to say, he's a teacher of English, but I'm not 100% sure. You'll have to correct me if I'm wrong there, Daniel. Certainly, we didn't have that in terms of every student having access to a laptop. And we didn't really have that until all the kids came back in March. So clearly, that's something which the US did well, which we didn't. But how then, you're a teacher of English, and so how does it sort of affect, perhaps, I know that you're really big on, for example, reading fluency. How did going into lockdown teaching affect that?
I mean, all of the things that I was doing in my classroom with fluency, with literacy, with teaching literature, without being in a classroom, without being able to do turn-in talks, without being able to really cold call, I don't want to use the word compel, but like, I couldn't like have the learning environment to make kids want to participate. It like I wasn't teaching anymore. It was just, you know, a sea of black boxes on a screen, and they were my kids. So I'd known them for 8 months already or so. So like the communication was a little bit more, but it still like went from, you know, knowing and seeing a classroom of 25, 30 students to like 3 or 4 students talking in the chat. And a lot of students kind of just fell off. Like, I just didn't hear from them for the next 3 months, unfortunately.
So what were your sort of school structures like in terms of that then, when there were students who had the means to participate but chose not to? Were you at all supported by your seniors in terms of accountability for those students?
The expectation was every day, whoever like hasn't shown up, like when you do like your attendance, then they get an automatic email, and their families get an automatic email saying that they weren't there. And then we're supposed to call them every day, every class. So like if you have 8 classes a day and they miss all 8 classes, they're supposed to get 8 calls from their teachers saying, hey, you weren't in school. But you obviously can't do that because it wasn't like one student per class. It was like 50% sometimes.
No, it's one of those policies where I sort of see the rationale behind it, but I think it's been, and obviously you don't need to comment on this if you don't want to, I think that's a policy which has been made by people who you don't teach it with chalk face all the time, who are in these, you know, ivory towers, whatever you want to call them, in the high offices, and don't have to do that themselves. I'm not sure what you think about that.
No, it's 100% that's the issue. Our SLT here don't teach at all. Basically, once you stop being a classroom teacher, if you get into any type of leadership, you don't have any teaching at all. You're just doing that. So like my principal, former principal, was a teacher for 5 years, and then he became a principal after that, and he hasn't been in the classroom since like 12 years ago.
That's interesting. And of course, if anybody obviously keeping anonymous where required, or, you know, you don't need to be particularly detailed, anybody in the studio who has similar experiences or different experiences, please do let me know. I see that Ken Commando Tim's in the studio. So I think, Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, but you work in an independent school. So you might want to tell us about how your experiences of remote education were from the very beginning. I feel like, unlike us in the state sector, you were probably expected to do live face-to-face lessons from the get-go, obviously we can focus on the negatives, but also I want to talk about the positives, however few there may be. So thinking about opportunities for professional development, Jasmine, what were you able to take advantage of during the pandemic, given that, for example, you weren't in school any of the time? What opportunities for professional development were you able to take advantage of?
So I was able to attend a lot more events that were not in my state. So I watched like some research ed home videos. But then also I spent some time like getting caught up on my reading. Had a lot more time to just kind of do nothing. So I was like, okay, I'm going to read X books to develop my subject knowledge in this way. So I mean, that was like a positive, just because I had time to read and kind of slow down.
Yeah, good. And was there anything in particular which you read in terms of sort of in England we call it CPD, really? For example, I'm just looking behind me, I've got Doug Limov teaching in the online classroom, I've got Daisy Christodoulou, Teachers versus Tech, the case for an ed tech revolution. Was there anything in particular which you read?
So I loved The Ode Less Traveled. I finally got around to reading that, by Stephen Fry. So that was great.
Brilliant.
And then The Practice of Poetry, which is by Bain and I don't know how to say their last names, but my like knowledge of poetry is just like kind of weak. I was like, let me fix that a little bit. And now I actually like poetry, basically, because I read Stephen Fry's book. I tell people that all the time. I'm like, I didn't understand poetry before, but now I get it.
amazing. So sort of, yeah, no, that's brilliant. And also it's not just sort of reading around sort of pedagogy, but also around your subject, and also for pleasure as well, which is great to hear. Daniel says, our head teacher teaches a few lessons a week, or covers but only for the most difficult classes. I think that's obviously you don't expect a head teacher to teach more than 2 or 3 hours a week, I imagine, if at all. But it's good to hear that the head teacher is on the front line with the most difficult classes and really sort of getting in that grind. Thinking more widely in the US then, I want to think, because certainly on Teachers Talk Radio in previous weeks and months, we've spoken almost always rather critically of the government and the education secretary in terms of what has been happening regarding education, COVID exams. For instance, what role has the government in the US, federal government, played when it comes to remote education then? Has it been a help, a hindrance, or just simply a non-entity?
Well, the federal government doesn't really have much to say about education. It's down to each individual state how they handle it. So their guidance around, oh yeah, it used to be Trump. Oh wow, kind of forgot about that. so that was useless.
yeah, I was going to ask what's changed.
What I was in office. I mean,
yeah, I was going to ask what had changed under Biden and Harris, really. But I'll let you carry on.
So that happened, but then when President Biden came in, I mean, even then, it's still like the federal government has no say over how states handle their education system. For instance, like Texas and Florida. I think Arizona have been open with at least hybrid or fully open since September 2020. But my state only just opened 3 weeks ago. From March 2020 until April 2021, students in Minnesota were online only, but it wasn't the same in Texas or Florida. It's totally up to each state how they've handled it. My governor, the person who runs my state, he is a former teacher. And so you could tell that he was like on teachers' side with like keeping schools closed for health. And he's like health minded that way. But then eventually the pressure kind of got to him because online learning was not working, especially for the most vulnerable kids. And I'll happily say that too. I'm just like, I knew it wasn't going to work, and then it just continued to not work. People were just not learning.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, it's interesting, of course. I sometimes forget just how big the US is, I suppose, and sort of how big, you know, the UK compared to is smaller than quite a few of the US states as well. So actually having one single national policy for education, remote learning, I imagine would, you know, it just wouldn't work really. But it's interesting to see the parallels there compared to, for example, the United Kingdom, where we've had huge national oversight and very little regional variation. Talking about the UK and the US, Ben Jasmine, you've decided to make the move to the United Kingdom, and you are going to be joining, I believe, a London-based school in September. Why move?
I mean, the U.S. system, like, so my state is quote-unquote one of the better ones in terms of, like, educational outcomes, but, like, the advantage gap is, like, one of the biggest in the country. And nothing's being done about it. Like, we're still having arguments about whether or not phonics is necessary. Like, should we teach books or should we teach skills, like that kind of thing. And the conversation is going in the wrong direction. And I just feel like I can become such a better teacher if I actually am able to join a school that, like, has a vision and has a vision for how they want staff to grow. And you really just don't find that here. I'm 27 and like, I'm not attached to anything here. So I'm like, if I'm going to move, I might as well move now. So there's a little bit of whimsy attached.
fair enough. No, fair enough. If you can, then why not? I can see Noreen entered the live studio, and that was her question. The US's loss is very much our gain, Jasmine. When did you start looking for schools in the UK then? And how long were you searching for?
So interestingly, I had actually decided during the 2019-2020 school year that I didn't want to stay in the U.S. education system. January 2020 when I like put out a tweet like, hey, UK people, someone help me. But then the pandemic changed all of that. But I'd say like January of this year, of 2021, is when I started to seriously look again and just kind of consider and like had it. So I had like 8 people help me with like my covering letter and like just be so supportive just because school was just so difficult from this past year. And I'm just kind of burnt out on the U.S. right now. That's all.
Hmm. Fair enough. And have you got any questions about sort of teaching in Britain, which maybe for people in our studio, our lovely loyal listeners, and of course, if you're listening on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, join the Podbean studio and interact with us live right now. What questions do you have, say, for us UK teachers about what it is like to be teaching here?
I mean, I don't know if I have a question for you guys. Like I have like a couple of friends that I talk to like every day that are British. And so like I was just talking to a friend last night and we spent probably like an hour just talking about the differences. So that's like part of my like daily, just like, oh, that doesn't happen here. Yeah, we don't do that. Just like big things. Our inset's totally different. He was like, it shouldn't be for CPD. And I'm like, that's all our inset is.
Well, to be honest, I think inset should be for CPD, but you know, I don't really get a say on that. Has Ofsted been mentioned to you yet?
Yeah. Yep. That, I looked up my school's Ofsted report before I applied.
Yeah. To be honest, I'm not sure whether anybody here will agree or disagree in the studio. Ofsted doesn't tell you everything. Ofsted tells you what it's like on a good day, and I'm sure. I know the school where you're going, and it's a really, really good school. Ofsted doesn't tell you everything, and certainly if Tom Rogers is still listening, Tom's got some very, very strong views on Ofsted. And Daniel says school organisations do CPD in twilights. Yeah, so we have. So in our setting, we have CPD organised after school, whether that's on a whole school level, on a faculty level, on a pastoral level, on a personal level. So yeah, we have that. Final question, Jasmine. As we emerge from the pandemic. Both in the US and the UK, or either or, take your pick. What should be the priorities for schools and for teachers?
I have a former colleague who he says, keep the main thing the main thing. And so we're teachers. Our purpose is to teach and to create a safe environment and to create routines and structures that help students flourish. And so that's what our priority needs to be, is reestablishing a sense of, I don't want to call it normalcy because I hate that word, but like a sense of like, all right, like back to the things that we know we can do well, get back into our routines and our, you know, there's comfort in routine. And so I think that's where we go back.
Just establishing those routines. And a final thing, you're based in the United States at the moment, so you're not eligible, unfortunately, until you move to win yourself a Teachers Talk Radio mug. But is there anybody in the UK you would like to nominate to receive a Teachers Talk Radio mug?
Daniel Bundred can have it.
Fantastic. I will put Daniel's name in a hat for the draw later today in the show. Thank you so much, Jasmine. And before you go, big thank you to everybody here on Teachers Talk Radio. We are really looking forward to having you in the UK from September. The US's loss is our gain. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye, you guys.
Bye. That was really, really exceptional chat there with Jasmine Lane. I'm going to give her a massive round of applause. And I'm delighted to say now we have Johnny Utley in the studio. But before we hear from Johnny, I'm going to play you your latest education news. Once I find it on this tiny little grey scroll bar, which I have to find all of my little jingles. Here we go.
This is Teachers Talk Radio. And this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Sebastian Sagnier.
I am Sebastian Sagnier. And this is Teachers Talk Radio with the news. The First Lady Jill Biden will be welcoming students across America to the nation's capital in a virtual trip to Washington, D.C. It is the latest virtual trip produced by Discovery Education, a global edtech leader. The Shadow's Child Poverty Minister, Wes Streeting, has warned that the government will face the impact of what he called recent grotesque school budget cuts. He also revealed he is undergoing treatment for kidney cancer. The popular Netflix show, Sex Education, is rumoured to be aired this June or July. This comes at a time of much discussion over the government's new RSE curriculum that is now compulsory for all schools. This is Teachers Talk Radio, and that was the news with me, Sebastian Sagnier.
Thank you to Sebastian Sagnier for that news there. And again, we send our very best wishes and a speedy recovery to Johnny Utley. I think we have a new guest to West Streeting, my word. And we send our best wishes, of course, to Johnny Utley, who's here, and best wishes and a speedy recovery to West Streeting. We have a guest. Johnny, I'm not sure whether you're on mute or unmute. Can you try talking, see if we can hear you? You might be on mute. Let's try again. Has that worked? One moment. It says that you're not muted. I'm going to try that. Oh, no. Right. I can't hear you. And no matter what I do, I press mute or unmute, I can't hear you.
I think it's my phone.
Oh, fantastic. I can hear you now. Fantastic. So we have Johnny Utley here, who is CEO of the Education Alliance Multi-Academy Trust in Yorkshire and the Humber. He's an experienced head teacher and a national leader of education, and he has co-authored the book Putting Staff First with John Thompson, outgoing head teacher at Huntington School in York. Johnny has co-authored an open letter to Ofqual as one of 24 trust and school leaders, which has been doing the rounds on social media last night, raising particular concern over a number of issues, but particularly the timeliness of decision making for 2022 exams. Johnny has also appeared on Teachers Talk Radio before, I think with Dan Edwards, and we're grateful that he's agreed to come on again at such short notice. How are you, Johnny?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah,
it's fantastic. Fantastic. Really good to have you on as well. So first things first, as a CEO, have you found the process of both centre-assessed grades last year and teacher-assessed grades this year? What have been the challenges?
I mean, from the perspective of CEO, the main challenge is the fact that ultimately the buck stops with me. Me and the heads of centre have got to sign off the grades and say that they're fair and accurate. We take that really, really seriously. I think I'm fortunate in the sense that I'm protected from the sort of horror and the workload of it, which is inflicted on particularly on year 11 and year 13 teachers and subject leaders. I think it's one of those examples, you know, talking to my heads, there's four secondary heads in my trust, and talking to them, they're enormously grateful that they are in a trust at this point, because we have got people, you know, really skilled people in our central team who've done a lot of the coordination and tried to do some of the heavy lifting around the process. But it's not, you know, it's not what anybody would want to do. We recognise, you know, given that exams have been cancelled, it was always going to be difficult. But as we said in the letter, the lack of timely information and process is really, it's just been unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I noticed as well that last summer, entry to sixth form in your trust schools was based actually before the algorithm was dropped on the centre assessed grades given. Obviously, that was the right decision, especially given what happened with the algorithm. But that already suggests, right, that there is a lack of trust in the process from last year, and that sort of carried on to this year. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the issue last year was, and this is what is sort of making us particularly cross this year, is it was frankly bleeding obvious from the start that it was never going to work with centre assessed grades with an algorithm. And the reason for that, and it was, you know, this isn't the wisdom of hindsight, there's plenty of people saying it well in advance, that ultimately Ofqual and the government refused to break away from their obsession with comparable outcomes. So they were so determined that the 2020 outcomes would be in line with 19 and 18 and 17 and so on, because the thought of grade inflation for them is just too horrendous to say. Problem being is that the instructions that centres were given made grade inflation inevitable. And I'll give you two examples of why. Firstly, and people seem to have forgotten this, Ofqual seem to have forgotten it, the instruction we were given in 2020 was for teachers to give the grade that the student was most likely to achieve had they gone into the exams. So not the grade that they were cast iron guaranteed nailed on to get, but the one they are most likely to get. So if you look at, you know, statistics and chances and all that, if you've got a kid who's got a 40% chance of getting an A, a 30% chance of getting a B, and a 30% chance of getting a C, then you have to give them an A. The only thing about that is that there's a 60% chance that they won't get the A. And that's just statistics. And that's not teachers cheating. That's not anything else. Some of the stuff that, you know, when Williamson came out last summer and said that without an algorithm, some centres will literally put every student in for an A star, A or B. I mean, you know, that told us everything that we needed to know about how the profession is seen. But yes, it flew in the face of the instruction that was given, because the instruction that was given inevitably would lead to grade inflation. And then they tried to wrestle that away with the algorithm, and then they abandoned the algorithm, and everybody saw it coming.
I'm going to go a little bit off script here. I don't mind, but I want to talk about that with reference to the 2021 results as well, because we were told no algorithm, and that actually these are teacher assessed grades. We've got to make holistic judgments. But then later on in the process, we were told they have to be sort of in line with 2019 results. So is that not an algorithm by proxy then?
It is. I mean, you know, what's happened this time is that we've been given these grade descriptors that aren't really descriptors, are they? Because they basically say...
No, we're not using them at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a joke. But the problem we've got now is that all of the grades have to be evidence based on actual attainment. So the problem that we've got now for these young people is because they have been disrupted, you know, we're not allowed to take into account, as you know, last year was a professional judgment about trajectory. This year it's not. And the problem is that if every centre in the country holds absolutely to the letter to that, then we're not even going to get anywhere near 2019. We're going to be way below because the kids' learning has been disrupted.
Yeah.
So what they've tried to do this time is they've tried to remove any sense of professional judgment whatsoever, and the consequence of that is actually likely to be depression of grades, and that's not fair, you know, on the young people. So, you know, it's just, to me, it's a different version of getting it wrong.
That's interesting. Certainly once the grades are published in August and all of the furor which will inevitably happen afterwards has died down, I'm sure I'll share a couple of my experiences and a couple of my stories around that as well. But while we're still in the process of our answers are in basically now to be QA'd, but so I can't really talk about it now, otherwise I'll be breaking my school centre policy. But moving on, 2022 exams were featured quite heavily in your open letter about a detailed, credible national plan for current year 10 and 12 students who have been enormously disrupted by the pandemic. What should exams look like in 2022, and when should we find out what they'll look like?
Well, first of all, they should do them.
Yes.
You know, they've got to take place, and there's no reason to think that they won't. That said, I do also think that there should be some proper planning going in the background, because we've got absolutely no idea what's going to happen with the virus going forward. We don't know about, you know, variants and so on. So let's work on the assumption that they happen. And we all know that the kids who are taking them have had 2 years of disruption, that there is a huge discrepancy across the country between the type of lessons that they had in lockdown, the different levels of infection and disruption. But even within schools, you know, we've got, you know, where a bubble's had to go home or a class that's had to go home, you've got kids from the autumn term this year who might have had 8 weeks out, and then you've got others who've had none out. So to me, the only way to address that is to introduce a whole range of options in terms of what kids answer in the exams. Because then, so, you know, you can stick entirely to the syllabus and the schemes of learning, but you can say, you know, rather than you answer this question, there's four or five different ones that you can choose from. And it seems to me that that would allow young people and centres to match the the way that they're assessed to the areas that they feel strongest in.
That's interesting. So, but you know, schools are already halfway through their GCSE and A level specifications or syllabi, and certainly now would that not disadvantage some schools who may have taught things which they won't end up having, which kids won't end up being having to revise? I know in our situation, we've taken a gamble, if you like, and said that they're probably going to do the same thing which they did last year in history and say that we don't have to do one option. But some schools won't have done that and might be teaching something which they haven't done. So there just isn't a perfect solution, is there?
There is no perfect solution, but the longer we wait, the less perfect the solution becomes. And the thing that we're calling for, you know, and it get this, you know, there's a genuine anger on my part about this, because last June, schools were told to plan for four different scenarios for opening in September, and we did it, and we put a huge amount of effort into it. So there was the full opening, there was the week on, week off, and there was the partial closure and the full closure. We did all of that. And when we got to the autumn term, as soon as it became politically inconvenient to go to rotas, the department scrapped it. So we did all of that work, and none of it ever kicked in. And the reason it didn't kick in is because it was politically inconvenient. But that's fine. But my question is, where was Ofqual? Where was Ofqual? Where were the government in September saying there is a reasonable possibility that exams won't go ahead next summer? And instead of cancelling them in January and then launching into a consultation, why was the consultation not going on in September? And the only reason I can think of is because it was politically inconvenient to raise the possibility that exams might not go ahead. And that was just a dereliction of duty.
Definitely. While there is all this conversation about whether or not we'd have another lockdown or whether or not there'd be a second spike, no, I'll definitely get your point on that. The open letter then goes on to say that we've touched on this already. The open letter says there's a real lack of trust in school teachers and leaders' professionalism from Ofqual and the DfE. Why do you think this is?
I think it's because it's inconvenient to them that we can basically see through stuff. And again, I'll give you an example of last summer with comparable outcomes. It's inconvenient for us to speak out and to tell Ofqual and others that things aren't going to work. And therefore, the best thing to do is to try and sideline the profession. That's the only conclusion I can really come to. Because again, you know, you to have a situation last summer, and again, I'll give you another example. You've got a class of 15 doing A-level history, and you think, right, five of these are most likely to get an A. And we've all taught classes like that. Yep. So you've got five kids who are most likely to get an A, but you also know, because it happens every year, that one of them is going to misread a question and they're going to slip to a B. And you also know that one of them is going to get dumped by their girlfriend or their boyfriend a week before, and the head's not going to be the right place, and they're going to drop to a C. So actually, three out of five are going to get the A. But last summer, how were we to predict that? Who were we to say which one would misread the question and which one would get dumped by the girlfriend? And that's fundamentally why it was never going to work last year. And that's why we were saying it. And I think because Ofqual and the government were found out last summer, they want to silence us and they want to ignore us. And the best way to do it is to do what they've done, which is effectively just run roughshod over the profession and put things out late and tell us just to suck it up. And it's not good enough. And it's not good enough because it's not fair on young people. The idea that you're in year 11, your exams get cancelled in January, and you're not told till Easter about how your grades are going to be awarded is an indefensible position. When, you know, I have some sympathy for last summer because none of us saw it coming. Yeah. But my God, we saw it coming in September.
Yep. And I'm just reminded, I think I am allowed to say this, what one of my year 11 students told me only a couple of months ago, I think, and it was they told us that exams would be cancelled in January, but now we're still doing exams, they're just not called exams. So yeah. I think it's been frustrating, and my word, I've got my lovely year, well, sometimes lovely year 11 class for history this year, and my word, and some of them have really worked really hard in the last couple of months and have really, really pulled out the bag. But then you have examples of students who just, you know, who misread the question. We've had that in a couple of assessments as well. So it's just been really, really, really tough for year 11s. And I think, you know, teachers are going through great stresses, school leaders are going through great stresses. I think it's the students who we need to be watching out for most of all. We've spoken about Ofqual, we've spoken indirectly about exam boards. What are you expecting in terms of response? What would you like to see?
I just want some honesty. I just want them to address the points that we've made. I want a proper explanation from Ofqual about why every centre in this country has to send in a sample of work that's going to sit on a shelf unread, and why they're not using the intelligence that they've got. So, you know, there are some centres, there's a small number of centres who last summer will have got away with inflating grades unfairly. The boards in Ofqual know who those centres are. They're the ones who should be sending the samples. We shouldn't all be put on the naughty step. I've got, you know, there needs to be a proper QA process, but the idea that we all have to send samples of work, which they say themselves they're not going to look at, just smacks of a lack of trust. And I want a proper explanation around that. And I want some pressure being put on the exam boards as quickly as possible to send itemized bills into schools, because I want to know, you know, it's no good AQA coming out yesterday and patronizing heads and saying we just don't understand how hard they're working. It's a ridiculous position to take. I'm responsible for £30 million of public money, and I'm accountable directly to Parliament as accounting officer. And if I'm going to be spending hundreds of thousands of pounds and handing it over to a private organisation like Pearson, I want to know what I'm paying.
So, yeah, no, they...
You know, we recognise this...
Yes, Dave Cunningham, who I'd love to call in and tell us, says this year will be significantly worse in terms of grade inflation. Would love to hear what you think about that, Dave. Kate Jones says, Johnny's right. What does he say about staff workload and well-being? Not good. So if you are getting itemised invoices, and if exam boards are giving a rebate, how would you use the money as a trust?
Well... What we did last summer, I'll give you an example of what we did last year. Last year, when it took the government 6 weeks to sort out a voucher scheme, we were buying supermarket vouchers for kids with free school meals for 6 weeks. So we actually put some of our rebate towards paying for that. So rather than paying exam boards, we fed kids. I think what should be happening this year is there should be some financial recognition for the work that individual teachers are doing, because they're effectively doing the work of the exam boards. I think we could also put it towards in our trust, we're losing £60,000 next year of pupil premium, because the government shifted the date from January back to October. And there's a whole load of stuff out there. So yeah. I could put £60,000 towards catch up for disadvantaged kids. There's a whole range of stuff that we could use the money for. But it's certainly not an acceptable proposition that taxpayers' money is being spent for work that's not been done.
Yes. Ellen, I see you've just joined the studio. If you want to press one of the call-in icons, and I'll mute you until we finish with Johnny and we'll let you in. Really, really good to hear that you'd consider perhaps, giving some of that money to teachers as well. Certainly, I saw there was one individual, I can't remember, was tweeting the story from one of the education journalists and was saying, well, it'd be really good if the money could go to the teachers. So it's really good to hear you talk about that. I'm not entirely sure how much depth we've covered this PP scandal in terms of funding, but it's certainly something which I want to look at going forward. Before my final question, I just thought I'd drop in this little statistic in here. Pearson, the exam board Pearson's operating profits in 2019 were £275 million. In 2020, they were £411 million. So it's not as if the money isn't there. Daniel Brundred says, use the money to maybe fund the summer school. Now, that's one which you might want to think about, Johnny. And Jasmine Lane says, the issue of grade inflation is so real. It's exactly the issue here in the States. in terms of how we assess, because there's no external moderation, no alignment across schools or states. And certainly one thing which I was looking at when I did, before I went into the segment with Jasmine, was looking at actually how do US schools assess, and the fact there are no terminal exams. Maybe we could have learned something from America, but given what Jasmine said, maybe not. Final question. It's a bit of a loaded one. Who do you blame for the fiasco this year? Who do you blame?
Sorry, I just lost the effort. That wasn't a tactical trying to delay. In terms of blame, I mean, it's not about blame per se, but I think there has been a real lack of planning and foresight on the part of the government and on the part of Ofqual. And if they respond to the letter properly, I hope they will come back and they'll explain to us what they were doing from September to January in terms of planning for this summer. Because maybe we're missing something, but it's really, really hard to see. And if it does turn out that there was no real scenario planning going on in the autumn term for the potential cancellation of exams, then that lack of process for me is where the blame will lie.
Okay, fair enough. Well answered. Of course, this is what the letter says. For the last 2 years, schools have done the exam boards work for them, but have still paid them for a pleasure. Ofqual failed thousands of students last summer, failed to produce a plan B for this summer, and is now passed but complete to schools. Final question. They're called teacher assess grades this year. So as a trust, do you anticipate teachers getting the blame for unexpected grades? And as a trust, how are you planning to mitigate against that?
We're refusing to call them teacher assess grades. They're centre assess grades. I'm not having my teaching staff in the firing line. One of the jobs of school leaders is to be a firewall for your staff. In the summer, we'll be absolutely clear that this does not come down to, for better or worse, does not come down to individual teachers. I will be there in the summer, and I'm quite happy to say I've signed these off along with the head, and any concerns can come to us, because it is interesting, isn't it, the shift from centre assessed to teacher assessed. And I don't think that's an accident. And people will make of it what they will.
No, thank you very much, Johnny. Absolutely fantastic that you were able to come on at such short notice. And I think we've really, really enjoyed hearing your insight and your wisdom on this particular issue, which is a live and a relevant one for teachers across the nation. So thank you so much, Johnny.
Thank you.
That was Johnny Utley there, and I'm now going to play, if I can find it, the Teachers Talk Radio competition.
Do you have something to say about the future of education? Maybe you have some positive ideas about the way things could or should be in the future. Then enter our Teachers Talk Radio competition. Submit a 10-minute video presentation to us by 22nd of May presenting your ideas about the future of education, and you could win £50. Our host team will select 5 winners who will each win £50 and have their video feature at a high-profile education event. To enter, simply send your video entry to teacherstalkradio@gmail.com with the subject line TTR Competition. We will announce the 5 winners after 22nd of May on Teachers Talk Radio live.
Thank you so much for that. And of course, a big shout out and a big thanks to Graham Collum, who does all of our voiceover stuff. I promised I'd read out what Jasmine put in the chat while I was with Johnny, and it was that she was Zoom bombed multiple times last spring. The intruder showed inappropriate images, played disrespectful music, took over her screen, even tried talking to her students. It eventually was sorted, but it was stressful not being able to keep them out. And certainly, given that safeguarding is everybody's responsibility, that would be distressing for any teacher. And I'm really sorry, Jasmine, but you had to go through that. Kate Jones says, we follow British examples, so same thing, as a British curriculum school. It would be really interesting, perhaps, to have a feature about how international schools following British curricula are are approaching the issue of teacher assessed grades as well. Daniel says, so things are just awful. Can't help but agree. And Kate Jones also says, Graham, you are a legend. We couldn't agree more. We have another guest. So let's see who we have. We should hopefully have Ellen Sherritt. Are you there?
I am.
Absolutely brilliant. I'm absolutely thrilled then to welcome my final guest onto the show. Ellen Sherritt is board chair of the Teacher Salary Project based in the United States. She previously served as vice president for policy and research at the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards and deputy director of the Center on Great Teachers and Leaders. First of all, Ellen, really good to have you on the show. What time is it where you are?
It is 7 a.m.
7 a.m. My word. So you're 1 hour behind Jasmine, who we had, so it's a good thing that we didn't get you on in the first hour. Otherwise, it'd be at 6 a.m. My word. Until we decide to do a 24-hour marathon of Teachers Talk Radio, I don't think we're going to have anyone on at quite that time. So thank you so much, Ellen, for coming on. Just tell us, Ben, about the Teacher Salary Project and what its aims have been during the pandemic.
Sure. And first, thank you, Tom, for inviting me on the show and for raising awareness on this important issue. The Teacher Salary Project exists to raise public awareness about the complexity of teachers' work and the importance of paying teachers a salary that reflects their value and that will allow us to recruit and retain excellent teachers for every student out there.
Fantastic. Thank you. I'm going to read what the mission statement says as well. It's about committing to working with everyone in the country to ensure teaching becomes a prestigious, desirable, financially viable and professionally exciting job we all know it needs to be. And you've been running since 2005. How can US teachers get involved in the Teacher Salary Project, in particular with the Teacher Salary Survey?
So right at the moment, we have a survey in the field where we're asking U.S. teachers, current classroom teachers, to share with us how their salary has impacted their ability to be as effective as they can be in the classroom and their ability to remain in the profession. The survey is going to be open for about another week, and all current U.S. classroom teachers are highly encouraged to complete it. It's at our website, teachersalaryproject.org.
Fantastic. Is there anything that UK teachers can do at all to support you in that?
Oh, my goodness. If UK teachers have relationships with US teachers, it would be great for them to encourage teachers across the US to complete the survey and share it with their colleagues in the States. But I love what you're doing, creating this cross-national dialogue. And the more that UK teachers can be doing that with their colleagues in the US and across the globe, frankly, to talk about these critical issues that we know are pertinent in multiple countries.
Great. No, as I say, I think the issues around teacher salary, even though I suppose the nature of the issues perhaps in the UK compared to the US may be different in some aspects, I think it's something that we could all fight for. Well, tell us about the wage gap, if you may, the wage gap in America regarding teachers.
Yes, teachers currently experience a 19% pay penalty compared to other graduates with similar qualifications. I think that's a bit higher in the UK. I think I had read it's about 9 to 16% of a pay penalty in the UK. And to put it in context, here in the US, that means that in 38 states, teachers who have 10 years of experience, who head a household of four, qualify for at least two government benefits, such as food stamps, that are designated for people living in poverty. Mm-hmm. So we're essentially putting our teachers at a point of living in poverty as they try to raise a family.
Thank you. Also, I want to ask anybody in the studio, I can see that Sandy's just come in. Hi, Sandy, but also Graham, Kate, Daniel, David, Tom, anybody else as well, because have you ever moonlighted as a teacher or maybe as a trainee teacher? Have you ever done a second job, which you may not particularly have wanted to do? Have you ever done a second job in addition to your main teaching job as well? Because I know that in America, what it says in front of me, 59% of teachers are taking on additional work to make ends meet. And in some cases, that's in completely unrelated fields such as bartending and Uber. Jasmine says, I feel the salary I make is good and I am very pleased with it, especially considering how you're not required to make any specific student gains in Minnesota. That's really interesting, actually. Dave Cunningham says, I was a nightclub DJ during my PGCE 4. That's the teaching qualification. 4 nights a week was tiring. I could imagine, David, at all. That must be pretty awful, to be honest. Next question. Because it's not just about teacher pay for your teacher salary projects. It's also about teacher value and valuing teachers, and pay is one part of that. So what impact has the pandemic had on how teachers have been valued in the US?
It's been up and down, but for the most part, parents are starting to really realize how difficult teaching is we've seen a tremendous renewed appreciation for teachers and their work. At the start of the pandemic, you had people like Shonda Rhimes, the producer of Bridgerton, and the comedian Jimmy Fallon putting out in the public the fact that they thought teachers should be paid $1 million a week. And of course, that is in jest, but the idea was that we are seeing so many parents who are realizing just how much we've been undervaluing our teachers to date. At the same time, as the pandemic continued on, we've seen some frustration with extended school closures and some misinformation about how much teachers are actually working during the pandemic, which has led to some members of the public expressing the opposite. But for the most part, there's a great renewed appreciation for teachers, and therefore we think it's an ideal time to really go all in at the Teacher Salary Project and trying to raise that public will and political commitment to paying teachers their worth.
Interesting. Thank you. Daniel says, I thought that early year teachers were in the first quartile of graduate pay. I'm not sure whether that's in the UK or the US, Daniel. It'd be great if you could elaborate on that, and also call in as well, if you like, and tell us what you think about teacher pay and what should happen to it. How is the Teacher Salary Project been helping to keep teachers, and particularly new teachers, in the classroom?
So we want teachers to know that they are appreciated and that the highest levels of leadership in our country believe that teaching should be a sustainable and prestigious, highly regarded career. And so the Teacher Salary Project is trying to encourage leaders from government, from business, from entertainment, celebrities from sports and cinema, and civic leaders to express the fact that they support teachers being paid competitive salaries. We think by getting leaders at these high levels, as well as just large numbers of the public from all walks of life expressing their commitment to a strong and well-supported teaching profession, that will be the encouragement that new teachers who have entered a profession in an incredibly confusing and difficult time will need to sustain themselves in the field.
It's not just about teacher pay, of course, but how else then, particularly with new teachers, can teachers be valued more highly except for pay, do you think?
So leaders can publicly acknowledge and just, you know, express their gratitude. We saw a lot of that during Teacher Appreciation Week toward the teaching profession. And our government can support high quality professional development. We know that many teachers say national board certification in particular is a great professional development experience that also contributes to elevating the profession so that it's more like medicine and law, where professionals do obtain that higher advanced certification.
Jasmine says, I'm not sure salary is the reason most teachers leave, in my opinion. It's issues with senior leadership. Jasmine, if you want to call in and give us your thoughts on how we can value teachers more in the US, then we'd love to hear from you again, of course. I was talking to Jasmine earlier today about remote education and COVID and the US. And Jasmine was telling me that the federal government had very little to do really in terms of remote education, and that much of it was done on a state by state basis. When it comes to teachers' salaries, I assume that states have their own policies. But what should the new US government be doing to raise the profile of teachers? I just missed you there, Jasmine. I'll try and get you in again. So what policies should the new US government follow to raise the profile of teachers?
Well, first, they should absolutely deliver on the campaign promise of increasing teacher salaries for the 50,000 Title I schools. That covers about 64% of children in the United States. And then they should encourage leaders at the local and state level to do the same. Like you said, a lot of salaries are decided locally or at the state level, and the federal government can do that through guidance, through use of the bully pulpit, through the creation of a teacher salary task force. Our strong view at the Teacher Salary Project is that everybody wants to see teacher salaries be competitive, be attractive, and allow us to recruit and retain great teachers for every student. But people, leaders in particular, don't often want to be the one to raise that issue because they worry they'll be laughed at and not taken seriously because of the price tag associated with significantly increasing teacher pay. So if we have our administration making these bold public statements about their commitment to significantly increasing teacher pay, it enables and inspires those conversations around the country at the local and state level.
Fantastic. Jasmine, you are back in the studio. Welcome. What questions do you have, or what thoughts do you have?
I guess it varies so much by state, if salary is good or not. Like I said, I'm very happy with what I'm paid, and you get like a $2,000 to $3,000 pay raise each year. And that's like because my state has a strong union. But again, like I quit teaching at my school this year, and you couldn't have paid me more to stay there. So it's like yes, teachers need to be paid more, but I think that there also should probably be a different focus on states where like you don't get pay increases, or where like you are living in poverty, because that's just, it's not the case nationwide. And I think it's a little bit misleading as well to say like it's a nationwide issue. Like I have a very comfortable middle class life now because of my teacher salary, and I don't have a second job.
Interesting. Before I go back to you, Ellen, your thoughts on that?
I think Jasmine's absolutely right that it varies from location to location. The fact is, nearly every single state is grappling with teacher shortages and has been for years. And it's not in every subject and it's not in every school district, but there is enough of an issue affecting enough students for a long enough period of time that we need to look very carefully in every state at the areas where salaries are not currently sufficient. And of course, it's not only salaries. Jasmine's right about that. But when you do have a high enough salary to kind of mitigate some of the other negative aspects of your job, it can help. Of course, not in cases like Jasmine's where things are just so bad, but it might kind of keep you in the profession rather than, right now we have 8% of teachers who leave schools per year, likely because of things like leadership, and another 8% of teachers in the US who leave the profession altogether. And when you can see, when you're well compensated, you at least can stay in the profession and look for a place where the leader is higher quality.
I'll just put up put in here, but apparently two-thirds of the US public would pay higher taxes to fund an increase in teachers' salaries, and 71% of the public thinks that teacher salaries are too low. And I think this is where the teacher salary project, I think, comes in. And correct me if I'm wrong, Ellen, but it's not really about convincing teachers that they should be paid more, but it's about convincing the public that teachers should be paid more. Am I right on that?
That's exactly right. It's about increasing the public. Sorry, it's about raising awareness among the public, and that's what we've been doing since 2005. And so, with that statistic that you just read, with 71% of the public believing teachers' pay is too low, and two thirds being willing to increase taxes in order to pay teachers more, we feel that we've been successful, along with many many other partners, over the past decade, but what needs to happen now is to translate that sentiment into real action. And we know that the will is there. We just need to make it happen and think that this is the time. We've seen historically, after periods of war, for example, that the public has a strong desire to come together, build back better, create a brighter future for children. And that's when we've seen increased investments in schools and in teacher salaries. And with the pandemic, we're in exactly that kind of situation. You know, there's the saying, a happy wife makes a happy life. Well, happy teachers make happy children, which also make a happy life. And this is the time to invest in our kids.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Jasmine, not sure if you've got any thoughts on that.
I don't like the rhetoric, like this is for the children. Like, no, it's not. It's because teachers deserve to be paid well. I think that's something that a lot of people in the public push back on, is the idea, like, we're fighting for the schools that kids want, but it's just like, pay me more. So I kind of push back on that, because like, there's nothing wrong with just saying you want to be paid more. But then again, like, I genuinely, you could not have paid me more to stay at that school. And that was one of the quote unquote better schools. And everyone that I know that's leaving teaching did not leave because of money. It was because of issues with leadership. That's the issue. That's a huge issue in education. But like, money is low on the totem pole.
But Jasmine, just to push back on that, perhaps, if teachers were perhaps paid more compared to other professions to which they're paid a similar amount, then perhaps they would feel more valued by students and by parents and even by leadership.
Again, like, it varies from state to state. Like, in my state, we still have a teacher shortage, even though we have like one of the best compensation. And that it doesn't make a difference. It's because, like, you, when you're working in a toxic environment, it doesn't matter how much money you make. It's not worth your life. So like, it's like, of course, you know, the teachers that work in Kansas or, like the schools that like divest from education, we need to probably be focusing on them and their lack of investment in education. But I just don't think that it's not the reason. It's not because.
Interesting. Thank you, Jasmine, for that. Final question for Ellen. The Teacher Salary Project has launched Teacher Salary Champions. How can a US teacher become a Teacher Salary Champion?
Just go to our website, teachersalaryproject.org, and you'll see right at the top a place to sign on. We're asking teachers, but also people from all walks of life, to sign on as champions. So we have doctors and lawyers and CEOs and state legislators. What we want to do is to show the Biden administration that there is such extensive support for increasing teacher pay, so that they do feel enabled and inspired to deliver on their campaign promises around the issue. And then we also want to be able to let them know that they can count on certain people, especially high profile people, to help support support their priorities on this topic. We know that there are so many celebrities. I mean, in the UK, Sting, for example, is a strong supporter of higher teacher pay. John Hamm. So many people out there have expressed their support on this issue. Matt Damon narrated our documentary film, The American Teacher. And we want the administration to know that there are, in fact, all these champions, because it's the sort of topic that that can get lost amidst all the other issues that Jasmine has spoken about. But I would push back and say that the survey data, national surveys, consistently tell us that teacher pay is a critical factor, and if not the most important factor for teachers leaving.
Do you think it's more what do you think sends a more powerful message? Teachers being teacher salary champions and teachers campaigning for higher pay, or for celebrities to bat on their behalf? And in terms of teacher salary champions, how many of them are you expecting to be teachers compared to non-teachers?
Well, we'll just see what we get. I mean, it would be a dream to get celebrities. So that's not something that's easily done. But I do think it makes a big difference when, not only to the policy push, but also for teachers, for those new teachers, to know that we have leaders who recognize that what they're doing is valuable and who are committed to seeing them paid as such. We would love to have teachers sign on as champions, but it's not what Jasmine was suggesting. The teachers just saying they want to be paid more. This is about us. It is about the kids. We have dire teacher shortages, and I know some people might not see that directly in their geography, but the data are clear that teacher shortages are a real challenge that are impacting student learning and impacting how students see society as invested in their in their learning, and that therefore influences their own views of the importance of schooling. And so we need everybody chiming in about the fact that's not the way that we want to live. We want to be investing so that every child knows that their learning is important to us, and that their teachers are being compensated for that.
Thank you for that, Ellen. Daniel, I can't actually see you on my screen here in terms of you calling it, but it does say connected with Daniel in the texts. So I'm not sure whether you are actually live and whether or not you can hear me and I can hear you. Possibly not. That's okay. Jasmine, do you want to add anything to that?
I'll just continue to speak from the people that I know that have left, and like, it's not just like pay me more, but it's how toxic schools are isn't worth the amount of money that people are getting. But also, there are some schools, a lot of them, where it's not worth it no matter how much you would pay. And again, like, if I were to move to Baltimore, I'd get about a $10,000 salary increase. And I'm already making pretty good money. Like, I'm not going to say it because it's weird, but like, teacher salary scales are public. And compared to the cost of living that I have, like, it's, like I said, I live a very cushy middle class life. So it's, I don't know. I just don't think that it makes sense to do like a widespread, like nationwide things. It's just not the same in every state.
Thank you for that, Jasmine. I should also point out from the UK perspective as well that the National Education Union, which is rightly or wrongly the largest teachers union in the country, has put a ballot for national strike action on the agenda if a pay rise of at least 7% for teachers in 2021 is not met. And that is about restoring teachers' pay to real terms 2010 levels as well. Ellen, thank you so much for coming on. And Jasmine, thank you so much for calling back in again. It's been absolutely fantastic to help you, and it's been great to hear about the Teacher Salary Project. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll tell tell you what, I've been going on now for 1 hour and 24 minutes, and but I did touch 1 hour and 25 before when I did the discussion about the model music curriculum. But it's actually quite tiring, but it's been made so much better by the fact that we've had three really top quality guests in Jasmine Lane, in Johnny Utley, and in Ellen Sherritt. Thank you to everybody who's been listening live on Podbean, who's been listening to the live stream on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube, or has been listening back later. Make sure you do share the show with your friends. You can download your show onto your devices to listen back at any time, even when you don't have an internet connection. And you can tweet us at TTRadio2021 with your thoughts on the show. I am the main Twitter admin, so I will see that. You can also follow me on Twitter at HB_history. That is it for today's offering on Teachers Talk Radio. Tomorrow we have the Fab Four, not the Beatles, but nearly as influential. We have Sabia's Stellar Breakfast Show, where she'll be discussing live whether UK schools are innovative and use technology effectively, the issues with ed tech in schools, and how we can use technology to really transform education. We have, he may still well be in the studio, Graham Collum on the Sunday brunch. He will be continuing the growth mindset chat. We haven't finished on growth mindset yet. Sorry about that, Graham. Then it's Khalil Rouse, and Khalil Rouse has a new slot on the Sunday lunch. He has moved over on a free transfer from the Saturday late show. He wasn't on last Saturday. My word, I'm really, really excited to have Khalil back on the airwaves tomorrow. He will be talking about how experiences as a parent affect experiences as a teacher. I am sorry, Greg. And then finally, we have Tony Breslin at UK Policy Watch, who is hosting his second Sunday late show. This is the sort of show where you can settle down next to your fire with a hot chocolate or other warm beverage of your choice. And he'll be talking about the post-pandemic importance of citizenship education. I also have an exclusive news story. Yes, and this is going to come 34 minutes before we tweet it from the official Teachers Talk Radio account. I'm delighted to announce that we have yet another host on Teachers Talk Radio, and it is Sam Elliott, also known as @AsboTeacher on Twitter. He has joined our hosts list. He's going to have a quick double whammy next week. He's going to have a drive home on Tuesday and a Twilight show on Thursday. And he's got two top quality guests lined up for that. I'm really, really excited. They are certainly going to be, if not controversial, then certainly talked about. He will then be doing the Saturday Twilight show, which I assume is between 6:30 and 7 p.m. from the 29th of May, so 2 weeks' time. Sam has been a previous guest of multiple Teachers Talk Radio shows, and we are excited to hear him on his own. On that note, that's it from me. Thank you to our guests. If you've got any thoughts on the show, then tweet us at TTRadio2021. Thank you for joining me on the Saturday lunch. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and I shall see you next week once I find the outro music.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.